The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour.
It was a Friday afternoon. Everybody's excited because it's the weekend. We get to class. They say, don't get settled yet because we're going to go downstairs and do the privilege exercise. And they tell us to all stand next to each other in a horizontal line and hold hands. And I was just like, I like moving. This is exciting. This is fun. This is different.
Priscilla Alabi is a radio producer, and she was the first in her family to go to college. And one afternoon during her sophomore year, the entire class was asked to participate in something called the Privilege Walk.
So my teachers, basically, I do not remember them giving us any kind of warning or prepping us in any way. They said, okay, guys, listen carefully. If one or both of your parents graduated from college, take one step forward. If you knew since you were a child that it was expected of you to go to college, take one step forward. If you're going to be the first person in your immediate family to graduate from college, take one step back. If you started school speaking a language other than English, take one step back. If you feel certain that you will not be followed, harassed, or watched under close surveillance while shopping, take one step forward. Those memories just like flooded back to me, these bad things happening to me. And I remember just seeing my classmates, the lighter of my classmates, just moving forward. I would like remember these horrible memories, and then I would have to step back. My taking a step backward meant that, like, the chain was broken. I couldn't, you know, keep holding hands to the person next to me. I could see them going forward, but they couldn't see me going backward. By the end of those 20 minutes, the people in the front were asked to turn around. And my friend and myself, who are two black women, were the only ones at the back of the room.
This all happened more than a decade ago, but Priscilla remembers it as if it were yesterday.
I remember saying to my friend, oh my God, I'm so upset. I can't believe this just happened with my Friday. We felt so naked. I don't think I started to process it until we went back upstairs and we all sat back down and started to go around a circle and debrief and talk about the experience that we just had. Like, just, I couldn't stop the tears. Like, I just was a puddle of water. Most people are facing the front. They don't see that there are people behind them. They don't see that there are people who are taking steps forward but can never catch up. They don't see the inequities. They just think everybody's just like them, walking through life.
The privilege walk exercise is still used on campuses. It's designed to show how power and economic advantage affect students' lives. Elite schools are trying hard to recruit students of color and students who are less well off financially. Yale University, for example, now covers full tuition for families making less than $75,000 a year. And yet the reality is that for many students of color, students who are in one way or another minorities, getting a higher education can feel like taking one step forward and then one step back. The Radio Hour's producer, Kalalia, has been exploring that experience, and in her reporting, she came to know a student named Manny.
So my name is Manny Rodriguez. I'm actually a senior at a liberal arts college in the Northeast.
Manny is a young Puerto Rican gay man on a predominantly white and straight college campus.
It's only recently that this school has actually made it a point to look for certain students like myself.
I met him through my partner, a professor who was assigned to be Manny's mentor. He's part of a growing group of students of color enrolled at private colleges. He goes to Trinity College in Connecticut. And at Trinity in the 1960s, people of color were only about 4% of students. In 2019, that number was 20%. Seems like a good amount of progress, right? But what's the experience of those students, and how much has it changed? There's a book. It's called The Privileged Poor by Anthony Jack. It asks some hard questions about the efforts of selective private schools to diversify. When it comes to students like Manny, is admission or even a full scholarship enough?
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm fine.
So where should we go?
So I have to a quiet, the quietest place possible.
Okay.
I don't know if that's, I would love to see where you're staying.
Okay. When I learned that Manny would be staying on campus during the holiday break, I asked if I could spend some time with them.
So this is like where the students stay. And I stay in this 1-13.
While the majority of his classmates were gearing up to go home and see their family and friends, Manny would be staying longer to earn a little extra money at his 3 part-time jobs.
You know, as the years have gone on, I've kind of decorated less and less and less because it's like I'm just here for the space.
Yeah.
But feel free to sit wherever you want.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm going to put my bag down.
What is that? Oh, air. A fan.
Okay.
His dorm room is pretty clean for a college student. It's decorated with flowers, Christmas lights, affirmation on post-it notes, some family photos, and a huge Puerto Rican flag.
Tell me about this flag.
Yes, I keep a flag on the wall just to remind myself of my roots and where I'm from, and I hope to go there one day very soon, actually.
So Manny's never been to Puerto Rico. But he says he's all about the culture. Just about every time we speak, he complains about the food on campus.
In our dining hall, there's all these extravagant foods. They have like a sushi section, a smoothie section, a sandwich section. And I don't think it's that the food is bad. I don't. But I don't eat like sandwiches. I don't eat like burgers. I've never really had them.
Burgers?
Yes, burgers.
So what kind of food would you like to eat when you came here? Like, what would be the ideal if the dining hall had what Manny wanted to eat? What would they have?
I eat a lot of Puerto Rican food, like pechuga, which is like chicken breast, and arroz con gandules, rice and beans. I love chuleta, which is like the pork chops I was telling you about, empanadas, and yuca, like all these different cultural foods. You know, that was what my grandmother made. I just want to hold on to that.
Manny was raised in Brooklyn, New York. His parents were teenagers in high school when he was conceived.
And so they were very young and, you know, and they hadn't, you know, finished their education or gone to school.
Over time, Manny became a big brother. And his mom, she never seemed to have enough money.
Like, I always thought she was playing. Like, why are you telling me you have no money? Like, if we have no money, how am I, like, living? How are we surviving? And so I would actually get really angry because I'm like, don't parents have money?
Manny figured out pretty early that he wanted to go to college. With the help from the Posse Foundation, a nonprofit organization, Manny was awarded a full tuition scholarship. His parents drove him up to Connecticut.
It was definitely a shock. Immediately, the first thing I noticed was how many white students there were. That was a big transition for me. But I did have like some of other Posse students. And so, you know, that definitely did alleviate some of the stresses and anxiety of kind of the, you know, social life. But in reality, it was very scary.
At Manny's high school, all of the students were just like him, low income and non-white.
I knew that I hadn't been living in the real world for most of my life. I made it a point, you know, to start college in a way that was different.
So Manny requested a roommate, knowing that he would probably be white.
He was different. You know, he came from a rural area in New Hampshire. I have my New York accent. And he was not very fond of that. And he would, express physical confusion with what I said. He honestly didn't understand my dialect.
Manny taught his new roommate a thing or two about New York. And his roommate, Jack, invited him to his rowing competitions.
And because of that, you know, we were able to get really close, actually. You know, and even today, like, we are very, very close.
Well, getting a full ride is huge, especially for a working class family. Just the basic cost of living for any college student can be outrageous.
I have three jobs on campus because I, for the most part, support myself.
What are some of the things that you pay for on your own?
Yeah, so I pay my phone bill. I pay for the food and the clothes that I have here. I buy my flights.
Right around the time he started college, Manny's mother moved to Florida. They're very close, but now it was much more difficult for him to see her. And pretty expensive, too.
In a lot of ways, there's a perception that I don't need the help and that I kind of have myself together. I don't, but I do want them to focus on my siblings. And I need to make money.
Yeah,
good. How you doing?
I'm good.
Good morning.
Okay.
Today is the last full day of classes before the holiday break.
What class are we going to now?
Yeah, so right now we're going to my biology class. It's called Genes, Clones, and Biotechnology. And it usually runs from 9:25 to 10:40. Right now it's 9:40.
Manny's late for class because he had to go to the DMV for the second time this semester.
The weekend, right? Uh-huh. I basically like lost my wallet, and I'm so upset. And like it didn't have much in it.
This time he lost his license, but the first time, a few months back, it was stolen.
I was robbed at gunpoint in my own neighborhood. And they took my phone and they took my money and they took like my bag.
It happened near his father's place in Brooklyn. Manny felt that he was targeted as a gay man because of something the robber said. In addition to the cash from his last paycheck, his wallet had a student ID in it.
Like, hello, my ID was stolen. Like, can I please get a new one? And they were asking me for money. And I didn't want to have to tell them that I was robbed, but they weren't understanding me, you know? And so I kind of had to like get into details that I would have rather avoided.
The school still didn't agree to waive the fee. He had to wait a week and ask an adult he trusted to intervene. Eventually he got a free replacement, but the humiliation and the delay on top of his stolen paycheck, it really hurt. And having to share the details only added to the stress he already feels about being a queer person of color on campus.
A student came out with an article basically being very transphobic, you know, speaking about the issues surrounding trans women in sports and in athletics. And so there's a lot of ignorance, I would say, and a lot of just open bigotry. I, along with I know many of my peers, don't see this as a, you know, we can have a difference in opinion and that's it. You know, this is our lives. There's been other moments where students have had their flags taken down the pride flag was ripped down one day from the queer resource center that we have here. There was a Dominican flag from a student that was torn down. It's an example that validates the fears of so many students.
It's starting to get dark. It's almost 5 o'clock. And he gets off at 5.
Manny has a class that starts exactly when it's time for him to leave his job.
We're going to be walking really fast, maybe even running, he said, so that he can make it before the doors close.
Hi.
It's dark now.
It is dark now, yes. Okay. How was work?
It was good.
Yeah?
Yeah, you know, around 5 p.m., like a lot of parents kind of rush
his
in.
Insane schedule makes it very difficult to get the support he needs from faculty and others.
I don't utilize office hours as much as I know that I should. I find myself so hectic all the time. And it also like depends on who the professor is. Like I may not feel too comfortable. I might want to have a professor one-on-one. And like in their office hours, they might have multiple students. I was nervous like in class, like to ask and answer questions. And I don't want to be like the dumb like student of color. Like I don't want to be the one to ask like the, you know, the stupid question or like give the stupid response. And so I felt the need to like go to my professor's office hours, tell him, I need you to know that it's not that I don't care, you know, but it's just really difficult for me. And he tried to tell me, you know, everyone has these questions, you know, don't worry. But I don't think so.
So I have to go to this door, but it's
by the time we make it to his 5 o'clock class, the building is closed.
Why? You're locked out?
I'm locked out, so I have somebody's number. This happens all the time.
Oh, God.
But it's because, like, the doors all close at 5 p.m.
I can't imagine his peers having to do all of this in one day. Class, class, work, class, work, and more class.
Oh, yes. I felt so tired for him.
There are no more classes the following morning. And the campus, it's pretty bare.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I met up with Manny just before 8 a.m. at the daycare center, where he's about to work a full 8-hour shift.
It's a little harder to be as excited.
Yeah.
But what I, you know, actually feel like good that, you know, someone else can like take the day off and and relax, you know, when I can help them in that way.
Hi, guys. Look, my shoe. I'm not saying one.
I like the shoe.
I'm not saying one.
I know. Hello.
How are you?
I'm Cavalier.
Hi. Hi, everyone. Hi. How are you?
Earlier, Manny told me that if he didn't get a scholarship to school, he'd probably be working at a daycare center, like his mom, or maybe in retail.
How you do it? Show me.
You actually have to have three jobs, or you want to have three jobs? Like, if you had one job, would that be enough?
I don't think so.
Or two jobs?
I don't think so, because there's a lot of things, you know, that I need to be buying now, you know, as someone that is practically an adult. You know, it's scary to say. But I don't want my siblings to think I don't care. They're so young, they don't understand.
He's got 5 younger brothers and sisters. And for the holidays, it's really important for him to contribute something.
I want to maintain some type of normalcy. And I reject the idea that, you know, that I can't participate in certain things now because I'm too poor. You know, like I want to, and I deserve to celebrate and, you know, and be happy and do things that anyone else can do. You know, Christmas is about family.
Manny is hyper aware that getting a degree will not only improve his chances of having a better life, it could affect the lives of his entire family. They're the ones who inspire him to keep going.
Yeah. Do you think that you are going to be a person that stays in touch? Like, this is your senior year.
Yeah.
Are you going to come back for reunions? Are you going to come back to see friends? To visit the rowing club?
Yeah, you know.
And now, the feeling that you have now.
Yeah. So right now, I don't feel like I'm going to be a student, you know, that comes back, that, you know, that donates, that is very involved in the alumni network. And I think that's in part because of my mentality right now. You know, I appreciate the education here and everything, but it's really taken a toll on me. And I feel like I have struggled to finish, and I am going to be crawling on my graduation day.
I ask Manny how the college could have made his experience less exhausting so that he wasn't reduced to crawling by the end of it. He mentioned a couple of things, like hiring a more diverse staff or doing some kind of sensitivity training for the tenured faculty. But there's so much more. Private colleges are generally set up for certain types of students, especially ones who don't have to work to support themselves while at school. In his book, The Privileged Poor, Anthony Jack writes, "The elite college must change, adapt, and grow, right along with its changing student body." Yes, scholarships cost schools money, but changing the culture of an old institution might be tougher still. But that doesn't mean it's impossible. Manny didn't have the luxury of choosing Trinity College. It chose him. And despite the challenges, he's glad it did.
I am blessed to be here, and I have to remind myself often.
Manny Rodriguez. The Radio Hour's Kalalea began interviewing him in 2019. Manny graduated from Trinity College last year, and he's now working on a master's in education at Johns Hopkins University. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
The way things are going on this planet, I've got to wonder if one day people will have to take their kids to Barrow, Alaska, or Greenland in order to see a white Christmas, somewhere north of the Arctic Circle. But since the beginning, Christians all over the world have managed to celebrate the holiday without sleigh bells and without snowmen. Alana Casanova Burgess is the host of La Brega, and she brings us a story about a very unusual holiday occurrence. Not quite a miracle, but close. For several years in the early 1950s, Puerto Rico received snow right around Christmas. Alana spoke to people who saw it with their own eyes.
Many years later, as he sat for an interview, Ignacio Rivera was to remember that distant morning when his father took him to discover snow in San Juan.
I thought that it was almost impossible for me to have seen snow, but at that time it was something that like came from the moon, something strange, you know, like going to Mars, something out of the imagination.
It had been announced in all the newspapers. Snow was coming. It was the early 1950s. Ignacio was around 8 years old, living with his parents in Barrio Obrero.
From watching movies, I know snow was white, but I had no idea what cold was because I'd never been exposed to under 70 degrees in my life. You don't know how it falls, how it accumulates, how it turns into ice once it starts to melt.
And it came. Real fluffy snow, cold and fresh from the slopes of the Northeast, brought to a city park for a snowball fight.
I simply enjoyed myself, had a snow fight with my friends, something that we knew we would never see again, because, you know, that's a one-shot deal.
It actually wasn't a one-shot deal. For 4 years in a row, kids in Puerto Rico were invited to the snowball fight in the tropics, to see snowmen assembled under palm trees. For a brief moment in the early 1950s, it was a miracle that kept happening.
Magnificent, magnificent. Maybe there was a subliminal message there, which I begin to understand at the tail end of my life.
If you've read 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, maybe the snow in the tropics sounds familiar. The first sentence is one of those iconic lines in literature. Many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. This happens in Macondo, a fictional town somewhere in the Caribbean. We never learn exactly how the ice got there, or where it came from, or how long it lasted in the tropical heat. In the novel, the ice is a symbol for a kind of wondrous progress, but also for something existing where it doesn't belong, a kind of dark magic. And here in the real world, Macondo is shorthand for any surreal place, where the unexplained is routine.
A crazy place where the most impossible things can happen, and people get used to it, and they don't even get affected by it.
Ignacio is a defense attorney and political commentator based in Puerto Rico, which, as it happens, people call Macondo all the time.
You know, if we saw a flying saucer land right down in San Juan, half of the people wouldn't even blink an eye, because we're used to the extreme economic and social collapse of the country.
In Puerto Rico, potholes are so big that people put Christmas trees in them to warn other drivers. Shuttered school buildings are taken over by vegetation, as though by force. But it's not quite true that nobody blinks an eye when these kinds of things happen. The absurdity is maddening, frustrating, stifling. There are protests and a level of austerity that nobody can get used to. And unlike in the fictional Macondo, where bizarre things happen for no reason, Puerto Rico's weirdness is often a function of a broken government and of the colonial relationship with the U.S. There are people in power who are responsible, who make decisions that affect people's lives. So even though we never learn how the block of ice came to Macondo, I can tell you how snow came to San Juan and who brought it there.
My population is about more than half a million.
Half a million people just in the city of San Juan?
In San Juan, which is composed the whole San Juan.
This is Felisa Rincón de Gautier, known in Puerto Rico as Doña Fela, or Doña Felisa. She was mayor of San Juan for 23 years, starting in 1946, and she was considered an incredibly effective politician. For example, she developed a kind of preschool system that was the model for the Head Start program in the States. She also expanded healthcare in the city, as she told WNYC during a visit to New York in 1957.
The physical facilities are not as good as I want to, and I am working for the plans for a new hospital.
But if she was a populist, she didn't look it. She had studied fashion design in New York and owned a clothing boutique in Old San Juan before running for office. She wore strings of pearls and elaborate gowns. Her long hair, first blonde, later gray, was braided and coiled on top of her head, defying gravity and also humidity. She looked like an older Marie Antoinette, if Marie Antoinette also wore sunglasses.
Like a queen, and imagine in a poor country, when you dress like that, you stand out.
Ignacio remembers her vividly.
People want to be like her. She played that role all the way till she became extremely old and retired. She was a very elegant woman.
Hilda Rodriguez was Doña Fela's assistant for 20 years. She's 96 now, and we connected in a shaky Zoom just after a blackout in San Juan.
Extraordinaria. No hay comparable con nadie.
She says the mayor was extraordinary, incomparable. Hilda kept Doña Fela's calendar and organized official trips. She remembers the mayor going to John F. Kennedy's inauguration. But there was one invitation that would cement the mayor's legacy. It was 1952, and an executive from Eastern Airlines asked if she'd come to a big company conference in Florida.
400 delegados, éramos tres mujeres.
400 delegates, only three were women. And Hilda says that Doña Fela would be the keynote speaker. When they arrived, the executive approached Hilda with a message. The head of Eastern Airlines would like to thank the mayor for coming, with a gift.
Quiere hacer un regalo a Doña Felisa. ¿Qué se le puede hacer? Un reloj, no me le regalen nada porque ya no acepta regalo.
Maybe a watch? Would Doña Fela like a watch? Absolutely not, Hilda said. The mayor did not accept gifts. After the speech, she was approached yet again. Give her only flowers, nothing more. But she told the mayor, look, this Eastern Airlines guy is being very persistent. Doña Fela said she'd think about it. At breakfast the next morning, she had a request. Snow. She wanted him to figure out how to bring snow to the Caribbean.
Sí, que usted me le lleve nieve a mis nenes que no pueden salir y cogerla así como yo la cojo con la mano y chupármela.
As we talked on the Zoom, I could see Hilda put her hands up to her face, mimicking Doña Fela holding a ball of imaginary snow, sucking on the cold. The mayor remembered that joy from living in New York. I want you to take snow to my kids, she said. Hilda says she'll never forget the look on the man's face when he heard the request.
Eso fue sábado, que regresamos.
That was a Saturday. They got back to Puerto Rico on Sunday, and by Wednesday, Eastern Airlines was calling. They would bring her snow. In San Juan, it was in all the local papers.
My father was a public servant, and he said that the mayor of San Juan, Doña Felisa, was bringing snow to Puerto Rico.
In 1952, that first year, the snow arrived in March. In future years, it came on Three Kings Day, January 6th, at the height of the holiday season. Here's how it happened in 1953, according to one local paper. In Pico Peak, Vermont, 2 tons of snow was prepared for its journey. An article in the Rutland Daily Herald claimed it would be packed by local kids as a gift for the children in San Juan, snow untouched by adult hands. The snow went into insulated bags that could hold 10,000 snowballs, no mention of how that calculation was made, and a snowman in parts, ready for assembly. Then the bags went into a refrigerated truck bound for a New York airport, where they were loaded onto a 4-engine Constellation airplane, packed into a kind of aluminum canoe.
A big, gigantic, like the trailer truck size. It was full of snow.
It was attached to the bottom of the plane, a belly boat. Once it arrived in San Juan, that canoe was put on a trailer and driven just a few minutes to Puerta de Tierra, a strip of land that connects the peninsula of Old San Juan to the rest of the city. Thousands went to a park there to receive it.
Llegó al Parque Muñoz Rivera, y eso fue inolvidable.
It was unforgettable.
Una cosa increíble.
Ignacio remembers he and his friends were so excited, they couldn't wait for the snow to be unloaded.
I was not that disciplined, so a bunch of my friends jumped inside the container. We had a snow fight with the guys outside. I began to realize that tennis shoes are not the best thing to be stepping on snow because they tend to get very cold. But I have no idea what cold was. So we had to learn the hard way.
Oh, you learn fast. You learn fast. And I had seen pictures and the movies and whatnot.
Antonio Martorell was 11 or 12 when he made his first snowball from Doña Fela's snow. He grew up to be one of Puerto Rico's most famous living artists. His portrait of Doña Fela is part of the collection in the National Portrait Gallery in D.C. And he remembers that she threw the first snowball ever thrown in Puerto Rico.
Creo que Doña Fela tiró la primera bola de nieve del país jamás. Y ahí empezó esa batalla campal.
And thus began a pitched battle that made for some quirky news back in the States.
It's a race against time to enjoy this foreign importation, for the mean temperature here is 73 degrees. So gather ye snowballs while ye may, the thermometer is too uncooperative.
In this newsreel from 1955, you can see hundreds of kids packed together with a flurry of white being hurled at short range.
A snowball fight to end all snowball fights, for 10,000 youngsters seeing this fleecy stuff for the first time.
The snowball fight isn't trench warfare. It's more a hand-to-hand combat. Men with shovels spread the snow on the ground. A boy in short sleeves zooms by on a sled. Doña Fela is tossing it into the air, her updo perfectly intact, enjoying herself. But the star of the newsreel is not Puerto Rican at all. She's a tiny ambassador for this white Christmas.
To San Juan, Puerto Rico, from New Hampshire's White Mountains, comes 12-year-old Nancy Conway, the Snow Princess. Nancy is bringing to this torrid zone commonwealth a commodity unknown here, but plentiful in Nancy's home state. Transported by airplane belly boat.
The Snow Princess comes down the airplane steps in a cable knit sweater and a winter hat. Doña Fela and a couple of kids in traditional costumes greet her. Watching it, you wonder how much snow is melting during all that pomp and circumstance.
Do you remember trying to taste it?
Yeah, I did. I ate it. It was ice, you know, a big surprise. In Puerto Rico, we put flavor to the piragua.
The piragua.
Which is a cone of ice.
With a syrup, with a sugary flavor on top of it, and it's delicious.
And it didn't taste like my piragua. It tasted like nothing, like water, which is what it is.
What's the fuss? There's nothing to it. Tastes like nothing.
Ignacio recalls the delight of the snow lasting hours. And so does Hilda, but not Antonio.
Because it melted right away. Melted right away. Didn't have much time to enjoy it. I think it was about, altogether, about 10 minutes. That was it.
He remembers all the kids showed up wearing white.
Las camisas, los pantalones, la falda.
And as the snow melted, everything turned to mud, and the illusion melted in their hands.
We saw that the dream turned into a nightmare, that the snow melted into mud.
That's the artist Antonio Martorell speaking with WNYC's Alana Casanova Burgess. Our story continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We'll continue now with a story of how snow came to San Juan, Puerto Rico in the 1950s. A gift from the city's mayor and delivered by Eastern Airlines, which milked the publicity for all it was worth. It didn't cost the people of Puerto Rico much at all. You could say the snow came with other strings attached, though. WNYC's Alana Casanova Burgess picks up our story.
Even before the snow arrived, there was plenty of Christmas magic in San Juan. Street vendors would throw an orange peel up in the air. The shape it made on the ground would be like a love spell.
And that letter would be your boyfriend or your girlfriend or the one you were supposed to marry. It was great.
And the holidays in Puerto Rico last from Thanksgiving through Christmas, then through Three Kings Day, and all the way to San Sebastian, a festival in late January.
We felt privileged in that way, and we still do, because we have not only one Christmas, we have two.
But by the early 1950s, hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans had moved to the States, part of a massive wave of migration. So Antonio and many other kids on the island were already getting reports from cousins about the glories of American Christmas. Of course, those reports were often exaggerations. Nobody wants to tell their family that they're struggling in some faraway, frigid city. And yet, to Antonio, it still felt like there was a message about living in the colony, that it was a second-class Christmas, even down to the weather.
You know, the leaves didn't change. It was a little cooler than the rest of the year, but not that much. So we did feel then that it wasn't a privilege to have this tropical climate. We felt really underprivileged.
But over the decades, Antonio came to see the snow not simply as a wondrous discovery.
Oh, absolutamente, asimilación. Por lo menos un intento de asimilación.
But as an attempt at assimilation.
Era el sueño del colonizado hecho realidad.
A sign that being Puerto Rican was to be less than, what he calls the colonized mind.
Not only snow was better than sunshine, but also English was better than Spanish. Being white and blonde was better than being dark and Puerto Rican. And being in the north was better than being in the south. Of course, it had to do with question of privilege, be it true or imagined.
But all of this wasn't only a matter of culture or psychology. It was politics, and it was brutal. In the early 50s, there were severe, violent clashes between the independence movement and the government. Wheels were in motion to make closer ties with the U.S. seem like the best option, and the snow was literally blanketing over that tension. The first year the snow came, 1952, was critical. It happened in late March, just a few weeks after Puerto Ricans approved a new constitution that would change ever so slightly their relationship with the United States. Puerto Rico would be rebranded as a Commonwealth, or an Estado Libre Asociado, a free associated state, which, yeah, doesn't mean much. Today, there's widespread understanding that it's not the same as self-government. Puerto Rico is still a United States colony, regardless of the rebranding. And Doña Felisa supported it. But Hilda, her secretary, says the snow wasn't about that. It wasn't a political manipulation. It was just that the mayor loved snow. Antonio says, yeah, but...
our politicians, or at least most of them, are colonized themselves, more so even than most people.
It's worth remembering that Puerto Rico in the 1950s was a place of intense poverty. It still is. San Juan had vast slums with no running water. The arrival of the snow, this extravagant fantasy come to life, was yet another sign of the might and wealth of the U.S. And it furthered this promise that staying close to the empire would lift Puerto Rico out of poverty. But 70 years later, that's still not the case. When Hurricane Maria tore across the island, it knocked out the entire electric grid. 4 years later, there are still blackouts constantly. The system was recently privatized, and the cost of energy is going up while the service is getting worse. And then, just last month, there was a headline that seemed ripped from Macondo. The mayor of Utuado, a town in the lush mountains in the center of the island, was going to use $100,000 of COVID-19 aid for the creation of an ice skating rink. At a time when electricity is at such a premium and people are struggling to keep their insulin refrigerated.
When there's another blackout, and it usually happens in the middle of the night, so you wake up because you're sweating.
Ana Teresa Toro is a journalist and novelist based in Puerto Rico.
The first thing I do is to take off my baby's pajamas because he's sweating even more than me. I will put a little bit of not toalla, of fresh towels with a little bit of water. And then we wait for the morning because usually you cannot sleep anymore.
She lies awake, her mind turning over the questions. Will daycare be canceled? Did she buy too much food the last time she went to the supermarket? Will it rot?
Is this going to last a few hours or is this going to last a few days? There's uncertainty. Everything in your work week goes off the rails. And there's a feeling of, you feel defeated because you start thinking things that I don't want to think. Why do I even bother? And then you start looking around and you realize that the world, it kept moving and you feel left behind. And of course, you could say, well, I could leave.
Ana Teresa lived for 6 months without electricity after the hurricane. Some people, like my aunt, lived a whole year without it. I remember visiting her and thinking about another part of 100 Years of Solitude. The residents of Macondo, the fictional Macondo, are afflicted with insomnia, and they all begin to forget the names for things, so they have to label objects with notes. Like, this is a chair, it is for sitting. This is the cow, you must milk her every morning. I looked around my aunt's home and saw the oscillating fan, useless without electricity. This is a fan. It used to keep us cool. This is a television. It used to show us movies. This is a light switch. This is a refrigerator, a washing machine, a cell phone charger, a lamp, and on and on and on. And when nothing works, people leave. Puerto Rico has lost over 10% of its population in the past 10 years. And people wonder openly, in newspapers, on the radio, on Twitter, if the government is actively trying to make life impossible for Puerto Ricans. If rich people from the United States are welcome to pay less in taxes and develop the island's coastline, while everyone else is standing in line, waiting to buy bags of ice.
Anyone from Puerto Rico that went through Hurricane Maria will have different relationship with ice. It changed radically. So maybe I was 8 hours waiting for the ice, and it lasted 3 or 4.
In a Caribbean climate, there's nothing more delicious than the feeling of cold, even the memory of cold. And so there's a different story about snow in Puerto Rico that has stayed with Ana Teresa. A story that has shaped her idea of what it means to be Puerto Rican. The big mall in San Juan is called Plaza Las Americas, and every Christmas it has this elaborate display of fake snow. 8 years ago, she went to write an article about it, and she had a pretty good idea of what she thought.
Look at the palm trees, full of fake snow. This is so ridiculous. To have fake snow in here, and this is stupid. And why are people coming to see this? Oh my God. And there was this woman who came from Humacao, that's like an hour or so, a little bit less than an hour, to San Juan. And she was with her two kids. And I was like, look at this woman. How could she come from Macau with her two girls? They are supposed to be in school. And to see the fake snow, how could people do this?
The woman explained that she grew up in New York, the daughter of that generation of Puerto Ricans who moved to the States in the 40s and 50s, who would have told their cousins about the beautiful snow at Christmas. In the 70s, many of them moved back to the island and brought their U.S.-born kids with them.
And she told me, well, I have no money to take my daughters to New York to show them how was my Christmas. So this is the only chance I get to share with them this very special memory of my childhood. And every time I remember that, I get goosebumps.
There's a saying that Puerto Ricans are Puerto Rican wherever we are, even if we're born on the moon. As long as people have roots in Puerto Rico, Ana Teresa says, as long as there's a love there.
Now, every time I go to Plaza Las Americas, I even stay a little bit. I look at the fake snow with tenderness, with emotion, because I remember that, yes, it's a spectacle. Yes, you could give it the colonial lens to read the experience. But also, there are human stories behind that that we have to respect and that we have to embrace as our own. Because Puerto Rican history has a lot of snow in it.
That's Anna Teresa Toro talking with Alana Casanova Burgess. Alana is the host of La Brega from WNYC Studios and Futura Media. If you missed any of today's episode, remember, don't worry, you can find the New Yorker Radio Hour anywhere that fine podcasts are sold. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining me, and have a wonderful holiday.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
With additional help this week from Jenny Lawton, Joe Plord, and Victor Ramos, and additional scoring by L.D. Brown of Grey Reverend.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.